Have you ever thought about how many decisions you make every single day? This morning, you know, you kind of rolled over and thought you'd just check the clock and see what time it was. And you saw what time it was and you decided, might as well get up. So you got up and then you decided, well, I guess I'll go ahead and get dressed. That would be the next thing to do. And you decided to have breakfast, or maybe you decided not to. I don't know about you. You decided to get yourself together and come down to the church building, and I'll just bet that eventually, sometime today, you're going to decide to go back home. Decisions. We just make decisions, you know. Our lives are a series of decisions always based on what seems right. I mean, say it with me. It seemed like a good idea at the time. Doesn't it always seem like a good idea at the time? Even the decisions that turn out to be bad decisions seemed like a good idea at the time. Hardly anybody ever says, you know, that's a really dumb thing to do, but hey, here I go. We always think it's a good idea at the time. And if it seems like a good idea, if it seems like a right decision, I guess that's another way of saying that it seems like the wise thing to do. At least I make that jump. That's what this last part of James 3 is all about. He's going to talk about wisdom. Now let's put these verses into context before we dive in. At the very first part of James chapter 3, he said, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers." And then he went into this teaching in the first 12 verses about how important it is, you know, how what we say affects others and how hard it is to control the tongue and just, you know, in the case of a teacher, just how even more important that is, although it is important for every believer to be careful, to speak carefully. Faith that works speaks carefully. And when he comes here, well, in verse 1, "Let not many of you become teachers." That is kind of, a rebuke. You know, you have to kind of read between the lines. There were some people that were setting themselves up as teachers who maybe James feels, you know, ought not to do that. There were outright false teachers, we know that, had come to kind of mislead the people away from the simple truth of the gospel. And then there were those among the believers who, you know, they wanted to be thought well of. They wanted to be puffed up. You know, like that one song says, they wanted to sit in the big chair. And so they would make themselves teachers. And James here has this mild rebuke, you know, let not many of you do that. Let not many of you become teachers. There was this, you know, competitive attitude among them that he's trying to come against. Now, down in verse 13, where we pick up the study today, verse 13 of James 3, he begins with this rhetorical question. Who is wise and understanding among you? Now, he's not looking for me. There's already too much of that. That's kind of the problem. And in a way, he's asking, you know, do you want to be known as wise? Is that what you're after here? You know, who really is wise? Do you want people to think of you as a wise? Do you want the big chair? Who is wise and understanding? Those two words we need to get a grip on before we can really launch into the rest of the passage. The word wise here is a word that means practical wisdom. You know, it's knowledge, but not just knowledge. It's knowledge that you know what to do with. You know, I was thinking about this today. You know, we have this new house, obviously, and There's a few minor repairs that need to be done. There's a little light that needs to be rewired, and there's the downspouts that need to be kind of redirected, and just a few minor things that we're aware of and I fully intend to address. But I don't know how to do that stuff. The guy pointed out to me, well, there's a wire in the pump house that goes here and it's supposed to go there. And I just go, well, if you say so. And then I start looking for Frank's phone number because he's the guy that helps me with that stuff, helps the church with that stuff. You know, when it comes to being a handyman, a fixer-upper, a carpenter, or a lot of things, an auto mechanic or a sheetrocker or any of the things that have been going on around here, seems like, I have no practical knowledge of those things. I am not wise in this sense. Now, if you need to reformat, reinstall the OS on your hard drive, I can do that in my sleep. You want to write and record a music and make a CD, and you want to make sure you get the right impedance on the microphone and the right polar pattern, and you get just the right level, and maybe you knock about 6 dB compression off the top of the peaks, Call me up, man. I spent my whole life learning how to do that the way that a lot of you guys and gals learned how to do what you know how to do. Well, when he says who is wise, that's what he's talking about. It's not just head knowledge, but you know how to do it. It's a practical kind of knowledge. Somebody defined this wisdom as forming the best plan and using the best means for its execution. Knowing what to do and how to do it. Now, the other word he uses here is understanding. Who is wise and understanding? If you've got an old King Jimmy, then you see the phrase there, who is endued with knowledge. That just sounds lofty, doesn't it? I guess it is. Wise and understanding. See, they're two separate things. This understanding refers more to a scientific understanding or an expertise. And that applies to a lot of things. And what you got to do here is combine those two ideas. Who knows what to do and how to do it and understands, the deep things, the science, who's an expert in these things. He says, is that what you want to be known as? That's the request. That's the question. That's the proposition. Do you want to be known as someone who has that kind of understanding and that kind of wisdom? And what he says here, I'm going to paraphrase, if you want to be recognized as one who has knowledge and knows how to use it, then don't just talk about it and try to persuade people with your words. Show how wise you are by the way you live your life and the decisions that you make. That's the rest of verse 13. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. What we're going to see here is a contrast in the source, the motive, and the outcome of or between, I should say, the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of the Lord. Let's read these again, starting in verse 13. So, who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, well, don't boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom doesn't descend from above. It's earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that's from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. The first thing that James points out to us here is that The world embraces false wisdom. Verses 14 through 16. The world embraces a false wisdom. Now, this false wisdom, as he tells us in verse 13, has three sources, so we'll know what to look for. He calls it, first of all, earthly. This wisdom does not descend from above, but it's earthly, sensual, and demonic. Earthly. Let's look at that one first. That's where the word worldly comes from. You know, earthly, worldly. It's of this world. It's knowledge not rightly applied. You can make the contrast between earthly wisdom and heavenly wisdom. So it's everything that heavenly wisdom isn't. You know, this is the kind of wisdom that we see in action in Genesis chapter 11 about the Tower of Babel. You might want to make a note, go read through that later, just the first four or five verses. Remembering that it's chapter 9 of Genesis where we have the flood. And chapter 10 is mostly or largely a genealogy. And by the time we get to chapter 11 now, the descendants of Noah and his family are beginning to populate and spread out. And they all speak the same language, tells us right there in chapter 11. And man already, just a, who knows, I'm guessing a generation or two or three or something from Noah and his three sons, already man has slipped back into that self-centered, self-focused, selfish thinking. And, you know, God didn't create any dummies, at least none that aren't pastors. And these folks are pretty sharp, and since they all speak the same language, they don't have any communication barrier, and they decide they're going to build this tower we come to know as the Tower of Babel. And really, it looks like a giant cake. It's a tiered tower, you know, one layer after the other. It's called a ziggurat. That's the technical name for it. Ultimately, the ziggurat is knocked down and it kills some people. That's why ziggurats are bad for your health. Pa-dum. It's another one of those required jokes like the Sadducees. Anyway. But the folks, talk about some engineering, you know. They made bricks and they used tar for mortar. And this is no small thing. In fact, there are a lot of people that say this was kind of the archetype. This was the dry run that eventually led to refining the techniques that were used to build the pyramids. How do you roll a 10-ton stone from the quarry to the building site there in Babel? Babylon, modern-day Iraq, one of those many wonders of the world that, what's his name, the mother of all dead dictators, was actually planning to rebuild, which kind of makes the point again. See, these folks, now you may have heard that they were trying to build a temple or a tower so high they could reach and, you know, touch or make contact with God. That's probably not the case. One good reason for that is they built it in the lowland instead of starting on top of the mountain. You know, if they're smart enough to build this thing, they would have been smart enough to start on the high ground to begin with. No, what the Tower of Babel really is a monument to man. You know, I'm so pleased with us that I think we'll just build this giant tower. And there's, you know, several descriptions of it. In fact, Herodotus, who was a historian, a Greek historian in the 5th century, writes of actually going to Shinar, or Shinar, however you want to say it, and seeing the remains. We're talking 500 B.C., before Christ. The remains of the Tower of Babel still there. They got to still be there somewhere. Who knows how deep they're buried. But this monument to man, this monument, you know, to how great we are, how smart we are. That's earthly wisdom. You know, we're going to build ourselves up. We're going to build a tower. The language says unto heaven, not into heaven, but unto heaven. Some would speculate they wanted to get up there so that they could see the heavens and engage in, you know, astrology and all those kinds of things. And there are some descriptions that actually say there was, at the very top, it was big enough to have a little temple, a place of worship. If you had the strength to climb up the darn thing, I guess you'd be doing some praying by the time you got there. That's the kind of earthly wisdom that James is talking about. Another good example, I think, of that earthly wisdom, and this really hits it on the head, in the 60s, I think it was the 60s, the Russians were actually the first to launch a man into space. You know, we remember the first American, but the Russians had actually beat us to the punch, which is why President Kennedy then committed the U.S. to putting a man on the moon, because we're America and we don't come in second place to anybody. And anyway, set that whole thing in motion. So the Russians, you know, who's an atheistic nation, when the cosmonauts came back down, and they didn't splash down, they came down with a parachute and thumped down, I guess you'd call it a crash down. And they came out of the rocket, out of the capsule, and they said, "We've been to heaven and there's nobody up there. Therefore, there is no God." That's earthly wisdom. That's, you know, a wisdom that relies completely on man's ability to think and figure and put things together. You know, only man would build a tower. Only man would be so arrogant as to go into outer space. Well, they go, you know, 50 miles or 100 miles, whatever that is, and all they see is stars, and oh, there's no God. What were they looking for? You know, a Starbucks or a living room or... Yeah, but now there's no God. That's earthly wisdom. Okay, the second type of wisdom he talks about here in verse 15, sensual. Sensual wisdom. That's the word, or it's related to the word psuche, which is where we get the English transliteration psyche, which you then again translate into what we think of as the soul. That's why a psychologist or someone who studies psychology is really working on the human soul, the mind, will, and emotions. That's what this word sensual means. It refers to man in his most base animalistic nature. Just the mechanical act, react, kind of instinctual nature of man. It's physical. It's sometimes, you know, a lot of times to understand a word, it helps to look at the antonym, to look at the opposite word, because then you get a good idea. Well, this word sensual, the antonym for sensual is spiritual. So everything that spiritual is, sensual ain't. That's the deal here. Now, this is the kind of wisdom, this sensual wisdom that we see in Genesis 15. The Lord has promised Abraham and Sarah that they will have a son from their own body. That's what the text says, from your own bodies. And this son will be a blessing to all nations for all time and your descendants. You know how it goes, like the sand on the sea and the stars in the sky. And X number of years go by, and it's Sarah, who decides to take matters into her own hand. And you might want to jot this down because it's an interesting story. In Genesis 16, she comes up with this bright idea. We haven't had a son yet. Now, God promised us one, but, you know, he's not here. So me, in my own wisdom, this sensual, earthly sensual, you know, unspiritual wisdom, I got plan B. Plan A didn't work. Plan B, I will give Abraham my handmaid Hagar. He will lie with her. She'll produce a son, and I will adopt that son, and it'll be as my son. Well, as you continue to read the story, as soon as Hagar finds herself, you know, with child, the word says she began to despise Sarah. You know, I can give him children, and you obviously can't. There's this attitude that comes into play. See, whenever you enter into trying to, fulfill God's promises for him, or whenever we try to add our wisdom to God's wisdom, we think he needs our help figuring something out or pulling something together, the result is always going to be a mess. And that's exactly what happened. There was Ishmael, and then there's a hassle with Ishmael and Isaac, who was finally the son of Sarah and Abraham, and that conflict goes on today, and that's what we see on the TV. That's why there's a battle in Afghanistan and Iraq and between and the Muslims and the whole deal. It's not about money. It's not about oil. It's not about politics. It's about Ishmael and Isaac. That's the root cause of the whole thing. And it all goes back to Sarah exercising this sensual, soulish wisdom. Always the outcome of using worldly wisdom to accomplish the Lord's work. Then the third thing he says here, the third source of wisdom is demonic. Now we can contrast that with godly, right? There's earthly wisdom versus heavenly wisdom. There's sensual wisdom versus spiritual wisdom, and now there's demonic wisdom versus godly wisdom. That's an easy one, or a relatively easy one. It's the kind of wisdom that Eve received and applied in the Garden of Eden. Surely you will not die. Well, the Lord said, don't even touch it. Don't even look at it. You know? It's not what God said, and the enemy is leading her, you know, down this path, and she's tries to argue all in her own wisdom, her own, you know, earthly, sensual wisdom, unspiritual wisdom, and the demon, you know, Satan, the serpent, influences her until finally she makes that decision and makes that really bad decision. You know, for all of these folks, for, you know, for Eve, for Sarah, for Haggai, or for the folks that built the Tower of Babel, I'm sure it seemed like a good idea at the time. You know it did. They thought, we've got, now I know, now I've got it all figured out. And they made their decisions based on this wisdom, this false wisdom. And look at the mess it all caused. That's the source of false wisdom. Number two, false wisdom is evidenced by its motives. Look at verse 16 as we jump around a little bit. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. For where envy and self-seeking exist. See, that's the motive. That's the motive. Why am I coming up with what seems like a good idea at the time? It's because I'm motivated to do that by these things. This envy and self-seeking. Your Bible might use slightly different words. It might use bitter envy. That's what it is, and self-seeking. Bitter envy and self-seeking in your heart. It's, I want what you have. That's envy. It's bitter envy. Because not only do I want what you have, but I'm thoroughly convinced that you don't deserve it. I do. Bitter envy, self-seeking. And so I put this earthly, this false wisdom to work to figure out how can I get it instead of you? How can I take it away from you? I mean, just, I don't know if anybody here reads the Wall Street Journal, you don't need to, but just the business wheelings and dealings, the stab in the back, the lie to the face, just to pull a deal to make a little money. And it doesn't even enrich the individuals involved because they're already so rich, they don't know what to do with all their money. It's just winning the fight. It's who can out-trick the other. Who can out-lie the other? Who can pull it all together and just have the, you know, the pleasure of boasting, I got you good. Why? Because of that bitter envy and self-seeking. False wisdom is always evidenced by those motives. You know what's awful is that's also the motive behind many successful ministries, as well as families and careers like we just talked about. I don't know if it's as prominent as it once was. You know, there was those televangelist scandals. Funny, right about the time I got saved, Seems like one day it was politically correct to be a Christian in America, and that's the day I signed up. And the next day, it's all over the newspaper, the headlines, the magazines, those Christians, those dirty rats, they're dragging Jim Baker off to jail. He's all freaking out, having a meltdown. And Jimmy Swaggart, the guy who was just the most condemning individual of anybody else, gets caught literally with his pants down. Excuse me for going there, but, you know, and the world is just going, I knew it. You hypocrites, you idiots, you believe a fantasy and you don't even live it according to what you preach it. You don't even practice what you preach. And it's all because there's this bitter envy. One televangelist wants to be, what do they want? More, higher ratings on the Nielsen numbers or more gifts coming in? They want more, little old ladies mailing in their glasses because the prayer cloth they received healed their glaucoma or their cataracts or some crazy claim that those guys made. It's all just this selfishness, this crazy selfishness. Envy and self-seeking. 14 is the other side of that. Bitter envy and self-seeking. Yeah, and then 16, it's the same thing, envy and self-seeking. What he's talking about here is that desire to build a reputation based on a false claim. Kind of, I'll say anything to do what I want to do, And it all starts in the heart, really. It's that attitude that says, I want you to think more highly of me than you would if you knew the truth about me. So I'm going to lie, cheat, steal, stab in the back, pull the rug out from under, whatever it takes to look out for number one so that I can be the one that's puffed up. My bitter envy against you and my self-seeking for myself. That's the motive of this worldly false wisdom. And the outcome of the false wisdom? Always trouble. The second part of verse 16. Confusion and every evil thing. Where envy and self-seeking exist, there's the motive. Confusion and every evil thing are there. There's the outcome. Confusion, disorder. The disorder that comes from instability, the reality that you just can't count on anything. Man, just, going through this deal with this house we just bought, real estate agents and title companies and, not to go into too much detail, but it's like people who I will never meet, are driving new cars because of me. And they just weren't, all along the whole way, it's just hassle after hassle. Well, you signed your name Ronald here, and you signed it Ron here, and so now we got to redo all the paperwork. And then you forgot your middle initial on one. And then, you got to give your wife power of attorney so that she can sign your name, Ron, Ronald, Ronnie, Ronnie Boy, Ron Bob, any possible variation, and then sign her name so that they'll think it's you and know it's you. And, and at the end, it's just this confusing mess. And it's like, look, I want to buy a house. Here's somebody who wants to sell one. Isn't it over? No, it's not over. Not by a long shot. That's the kind of confusion, that earthly wisdom. And you can't count on anything. Again, this house deal is a perfect example. Well, we're going to sign the papers on Friday. Great. Friday rolls around. Well, we're going to sign the papers on Tuesday. Great. Have to sign them without me. I'm going to be in California. Oh, well, we'll do this power attorney. We'll come back and we'll sign them the next Friday. And it's like, well, Friday afternoon. How about Friday night? And you're just like, you can't count on anybody for anything. And that's just, my own personal little business deal, you know, and these people who it's nobody's fault except these worldly wise people doing what seems like a good idea to them at the time and just bringing nothing but confusion into all of our lives and making the thing harder than it has to be. That's just how it goes. He talks about every evil thing. Now, I can't figure out why they used this word. To tell you the truth, I looked into this with every tool that I have, and it does not mean wicked, demonic, satanic when it says evil, which is kind of what I expected it to mean, especially since when he said demonic wisdom, and it meant exactly that, you know, finding its source in the enemy, in the accuser of the brethren. This evil, every evil thing, really means ordinary. Ordinary in the sense of worthless. You know, it's just another worthless deal. It reminds me of that 1 Corinthians 3 talks about the wood, hay, and stubble. You know, at the end, there's going to be a fire and all that junk is just going to burn away. And that's the outcome of false wisdom. It's just confusion and worthlessness. You know, that it is all going to burn. You know, and you can't take it with you. No matter what Frank Sinatra thinks, he won't smoke those camels they put in his pocket or drink that Jack Daniels they put in his casket or read a Bible that they might have put in there. I mean, you can't take it with you, whatever it is. So it's just kind of a waste of time. So there's the three sources of false worldly wisdom, the motive of false wisdom, and the outcome of false wisdom. That's the world. The world embraces false wisdom, but God's people, the believers, the family of faith, the church embraces true wisdom. Look at verse 17 again. But the wisdom that's from above is pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. See, the wisdom, true wisdom, has a single source. It says it right there. True wisdom, this wisdom is from above. And what he's talking about there is the new birth. Remember John 3, Nick at night. Good teacher, we know that you're from God. What must I do to enter the kingdom of God? And Jesus says, you're the head honcho, the teacher of Israel, and you don't understand these things? He says, Nicodemus, you have to be born again. You have to be born of the flesh. You have to be born of the Spirit. Now, the word again in that born again passage is the same word that's translated above here. This wisdom comes from above. And there are those, you know, sort of cult or cultish people who would make a big deal out of that. And it doesn't say born again. It's just born from above. And being born from above is a whole different deal than being born again. And, you know, let's think this through a minute. Again implies another time. You know, I'll see you again, you know, next Sunday. And I'll see you another time. Well, that's clearly how Nicodemus understood it. Jesus said, you must be born again. And Nicodemus says, well, what am I supposed to do? Climb back in my mother's womb and be born a second time? So clearly Nicodemus understood it to mean again, another time. But the word does mean from above, and you know, that certainly fits to be born from above. I mean, I'm born from below, earthly, you know, born of flesh, a natural birth, a physical birth, and then to be born from above, born again, this spiritual birth, the new birth. And then some people would translate this above, born from the top, which is above, you know, apples and oranges kind of a thing. And to be born from the top down. Well, I kind of like that. A lot of times when I'm in the middle of something and I get frustrated and give up, I just start over again from the top down or the bottom up, you know, whatever way you want to look at it. It means I'm going to take another run at this. Only when Jesus talks about being born again or born from above, he's talking about being born, you know, head to toe, being born, being given a brand new start, being born from above, being born of the one who is from above, the Spirit of the Lord, in whom, says Colossians 2:3, are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So this new birth experience, this regeneration that happens the moment we put our faith in Jesus Christ and who he is and what he's done, and we talked about last week, you get in the wheelbarrow, right? When the guy tries going to go across. When we get in, then we're born again. We're born from above and we get that brand new start, and it's all about the one from above, because in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, the wisdom that we need to make the right decisions, to be a blessing to others and a blessing to the Lord, and bring, you know, last but not least, blessing into our own lives, however that blessing might manifest, all starts with that wisdom that comes from God. Now, true wisdom is evidenced by its motives. And that's what the second part of verse 17 is about. There's this list here. I want to point out to you grammarians or students of grammar that these words here, the qualities that are listed here, are adjectives. What does that mean? I was watching the girl across the room in seventh grade English class, not the teacher, paying attention to the word adjective, smadjective. I don't know what that is. Well, when I was 50, I had to find out, because now I need to know. Didn't need to know then. Now I need to know. An adjective is a word that modifies a noun. What's a noun? This will come in handy at the inductive Bible study thing next week. A noun is a person, place, or thing. Wisdom is the thing that he's talking about, and these adjectives describe the wisdom. They aren't separate qualities. That's why I bring it up. It's not wisdom and meekness and peaceableness. They aren't separate qualities. They're all just words that describe the kind of wisdom, the godly wisdom that comes from above. And I don't want to spend all day, you know, going through the dictionary and all nine of these, but we just want to touch on each one. Now, the first one, you have to jump back to verse 13 about, because he says, who's wise and understanding? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. See, that's the first word that describes heavenly wisdom. It's the motive behind heavenly wisdom, meekness. Now, I don't know if we've talked about, I don't think we've studied through the Sermon on the Mount. You know, blessed are the meek. Some translations say happy are the humble. That's kind of cute, but I don't know how accurate it is. Just let me say this, and again, I'm going to go through all of these pretty quickly. Meekness does not equal weakness. That's kind of what we assume. If you don't know better, it's not a word we use a lot. You know, come home from the third grade, how was school, Johnny? Oh, I met a kid, he was really meek. You know, not going to happen. So meekness, and somehow we connect it with weakness, kind of wimpiness, you know, Casper Milquetoast, you know, a real wussy is what we think of when somebody's described as meek, and that's not at all what the word means. Meekness means strength under control. And the best illustration I've ever come across is just simply a horse. Horses are just basically 1,000-pound muscles. Right? We talked about horses last week too, didn't we? Just this 1,000-pound muscle, and you hope that it's well trained, because if it's not well trained, it can do some damage. I mean, they can kick, they can bite, they can, you know, do all kinds of stuff. that you don't want them to do. But when the horse is well trained, when the horse is under control, man, you know, that's who you want with you is your horse, cowboy. You know, he can pull you out of the quicksand. I've seen it on the Lone Ranger. You can get away from the bad guys. Even if you're as big as Hoss Cartwright, your horse will get, you know, and what's his name? Robert Duvall, sad story, killed his horse and got down and hid behind it and got away from the bad guys. You know, I mean, your horse under control. You know, the police use horse in crowd control. And believe me, they can say, you know, move on. And you can be stupid and stubborn and say, I'm not going. And they can have that shield and push you. And you just get up and kind of, oh, yeah. But if the guy comes by on a horse and that horse, you're moving. You know, his 1,000 pounds and you're 150 or 200 or 300 or whatever. You know, you don't win with the horse. And it's that strength under control. See, the horse isn't going to hurt you. He's under control. That's what meekness is. That's what humility is. We've talked about that. Same word. You know who you are. You know who God is. And you know how knowing who God is affects who you are. And you're confident and strong. Doesn't mean you're mean, aggressive, arrogant. But it doesn't mean you back down and are weak either. It's that strength under control. That's the kind of wisdom that's from above. It's meek. It's a strong wisdom, but it's under control, so it's not dangerous to anybody. Now we jump down to verse 17 for the next one. But the wisdom that's from above is first pure. That word first is the word proton. It means first and foremost. You know, it's like of most importance. The most important thing about this wisdom is what he's talking about. First and foremost, it's pure. And actually, the word pure in our English Bible, there are two words in the Greek that I guess a lot of the translators just kind of figured it wasn't important. But a literal translation would be truly pure. You know, really pure, genuinely pure. It's not just pure, it's really pure. So first and foremost, this wisdom is truly pure. It's a variation of the word hagios, which is where we get our word holy. That means set apart, unique, special. And specifically in this context, when he talks about this purity, he's talking about the aspect of godly wisdom that values the sacredness of your relationship with the Lord. Hold it so dear. It's such a pure thing that it's first and foremost in your life, and you're not going to let anything or anyone mess it up or confuse it or get in the way of it. This wisdom is first and foremost truly pure. And then, he goes on to say, you know, after the first and foremost, then it's peaceable. Remember, these are words that describe wisdom. It's not peaceable, you know, and wise. It's a peaceable wisdom. Now, the difference between peaceable and peaceful is important because peaceful is an experience. You know, we experience the peace that passes understanding. But peaceable means one who brings peace. Another translation would be the absence of rivalry. It's kind of the backside of that envy, that bitter envy and selfishness. Now, this is not jealousy. This is that, the lack of jealousy, the opposite of jealousy. Peaceable, bringing peace. This is God's wisdom. It brings peace. It doesn't set us up in competition with one another to see who can be more puffed up or more esteemed. You know, the only competition in the church that's legitimate is the competition to see who can love the Lord the most. That's a good competition. You know, Paul says, run. The only one wins the race, run as if to win the prize. Now, we all have already won. You know, we already have all got the gold medal. We just haven't been to the awards ceremony yet. But he says, run to win. And that's part of this deal here. peaceable, and then he talks about gentle, fair, appropriate, reasonable. And here's a real important aspect of this particular word, the wisdom, the gentleness of wisdom, or wisdom, gentle wisdom, that's what I'm trying to say. Gentle wisdom is tender without compromising the truth. That takes wisdom, doesn't it? I mean, you're not going to back down from the truth. You're not going to let sin slide, either your own or somebody else's, but you're gentle about it, always gentle, tender, but not compromising the truth. You know, when I go to the doctor, I want the truth, even if it's something I don't want to hear. I'm going to the doctor next week. I don't know what I got. The common cold or muscular dystrophy or brain cancer. I don't care. I don't know. I don't care. I love my life. To live is Christ. To die is gain. I want to know the truth. I don't want my doctor to be so gentle that she won't tell me what's wrong with me. I don't want to offend you. Using the C word or the M word or whatever the word is, you know, you need to drink more iced tea and you'll be fine. It could be something as simple as that. I don't know. But I want to know the truth. That's what this gentleness is. It's tender, but it doesn't compromise the truth. Next, he talks about being willing to yield. This is another one of those words where it helps to look at the antonym, to look at what it's not. The opposite of willing to yield is stubborn. That kind of makes it clear, doesn't it? The opposite is stubborn, just willing to yield. Not soft, not pushy, not wishy-washy, but willing to yield. Agreeable, cooperative. You know, love doesn't demand its own way, wrote Paul in 1 Corinthians 13. And neither does wisdom, godly wisdom. Willing to yield, full of mercy. Some translations say controlled by mercy. I like that even better. I don't just want to be full of mercy. I want to be controlled by mercy. See, godly wisdom, that's a controlled by mercy kind of wisdom. It's the kind of wisdom we see in the story of the Good Samaritan. Everybody remembers that from Sunday school, even if you haven't read it lately. There's a Samaritan who's an, you know, he's born on the wrong side of the tracks. And the nice people don't associate with Samaritans. And a priest walks by and sees a Samaritan. He's been bushwhacked. He's been beat up and robbed and left for dead. What does the priest do? He crosses over on the other side of the road. Keeps walking. A Levite, you know, a sort of the priest's helper. Supposed to be religious people. Supposed to be God's people. Comes by, sees the Samaritan. Oh, you know, no touch. No, you know, not going to help, not going to talk. Finally, a guy comes along and, oh, I got it backwards. It's the Samaritan comes along. It's a Jew that's hurt. The Samaritan not only helps the guy, he picks him up. He takes him down to the Motel 6, gives the desk clerk his credit card, says, take care of this guy, put it on my bill, no matter what the cost. That's being controlled by mercy. And the wisdom that comes from God is, these are things that motivate that wisdom. These are the things, the sort of underlying cause and character of that wisdom. Full of mercy, controlled by mercy. Full of good fruits. You know, good fruits that are the product of relationship. You ever notice that there's only one letter different between produce and product? You go to the produce stand, he talks here about fruits. The product of a relationship with God. This wisdom that comes from above is a wisdom that's, you know, the produce or the product of the relationship we have with the Lord. Without partiality. You know, not hot and cold. Not doubting one minute and sure and decisive the other minute. This is a good contrast. If you look back in chapter 1 at verse 6, You'll remember this because he talked about, you know, ask in faith with no doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. That would be with partiality. And this is the opposite of that. This is godly wisdom. It's a wisdom that isn't partial. It's not tossed. It's strong. It's strong, but at the same time, it's all these other things. It's still gentle. It's still willing to yield, but it's strong without partiality and without hypocrisy, which simply means sincere, genuine, not pretending or hiding. You know, you've seen those, where do you see it? In the theater sometimes, they'll have that thing with the two masks, the sad face and the happy face. That is the symbol for hypocrisy. It's an actor, literally two-faced, you know, because the actor is who he really is, but then he puts on the mask and pretends to be somebody else. Now, if you're looking to be entertained, that's great. If you're watching the movies and stuff, you know, hypocrisy can be cool. But in real life, pretending to be someone other than you're not, pretending to be more than, less than, other than who God has made you to be, can always and only lead to trouble for you and those that you're associated with. That's one of the things I think the hardest lessons for us to learn is that it's okay to be who God made you to be. It's okay for you to be you, and it's okay for me to be me. What's not okay is for me to have a problem with you being you, or you to have a problem with me being me. That breaks all the rules. This pretending, though, this hypocrisy, this is the one thing that just set Jesus' teeth on edge when he walked the earth. He hung out with drunks and hookers and extortionists, also known as tax collectors. The dregs of society, the worst of the worst, he hung with them, he ate with them, he drank with them, he talked with them, and the religious people just said, oh man, this guy is just over the edge. But when it came time to deal with the religious people who were drunkards and, you know, whoremongers and thieves and liars and cheats, only they're pretending, they put on the clothes, they put on the mask of religion. And Jesus, then he would just, you know, you snakes, you brood of vipers, you're all shiny and whitewashed on the outside, and on the inside you're full of dead man's bones. Jesus didn't just have a bad hair day and lose his temper. He was speaking the truth in love, actually. See, that hypocrisy, that's the one thing that Jesus just wouldn't tolerate. He just couldn't stand it. It totally goes against any sort of godly wisdom, hypocrisy. In fact, what we're seeing here with these nine descriptions of godly wisdom is really a picture of Jesus. You know, you look at the Ten Commandments, you get a picture of the nature of God. You look at the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians, and you get a look, you get a picture of the nature of God and the nature of Jesus. And right here we get the same thing. It's another, like a painting almost, of Jesus, of his character. And not only the character of Jesus himself, but the character of his disciples. He's describing God's people here, full of the wisdom from above, because of the one who's from above. Okay, wrapping this up. The outcome of true wisdom is righteousness and blessing. Now, there are those who would say that verse 18 really ought to be verse 1 of the following chapter. And I'm not, you know, expert enough to make those kind of decisions, but I tend to agree with them. I think he changes the subject here. I think when he says now, usually that's, you know, when you're going to talk about something else, we've been talking, I've done that, I think, here today. We talked about the wisdom that's of the world, and now we're going to talk about the wisdom that's of the Lord. And I think he's changing the subject, and it ties in really well with the next chapter, talking about wars and fights and stuff like that. But it also kind of fits in this context as the outcome of the true wisdom that comes from above. Verse 18, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. This is one reason why I'm just can't get over my dislike for the New King James Version of the Bible. It's like they took a bunch of words and shook them up in a jar and threw them out, and now you're supposed to make sense of them. I read that thing and I go, what in the heck is he talking about? And I got to read 9 other Bibles and 6 commentaries and analyze the Greek grammar just to start to get a clue of what he means. The New Living Translation does clarify it pretty well when it says, and those who are peacemakers will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of goodness. Well, why didn't he just say that? Well, he did. And when the New King, or when the New Living guys use the word goodness, they're talking about the righteousness that the New King James translators use. It should be righteousness. And those who are peacemakers, you know, those who have this wisdom that's from above, will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of righteousness. Now, when we say righteousness in a Christian context, sometimes we mean that positional righteousness that we're given by God. It's tied in closely with justification, which is tied in with forgiveness, which is tied in with redemption, which are all tied in with that big umbrella word salvation. The right standing before God that is mine, which is a gift of God's grace because of my faith in what Jesus has done. God declares me righteous. Romans says that I'm clothed in the righteousness of Christ. And so when God looks at me, he doesn't see me in my sin. He sees the righteousness of his Son. That's righteousness in one sense. But what he's talking about here when he talks about righteousness actually is a definition that we used a little while back. Righteousness meaning the state of him who is as he ought to be. Just the way I ought to be, the way you ought to be. Now read it that way. And those who are peacemakers will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of being who they ought to be. And there's a cycle here. You know, the plant seed, harvest, plant seed, harvest cycle in nature is just repeated here. You sow seed, you know, righteousness brings peace, which brings more righteousness, which brings more peace, and the cycle goes on, and you plant that into your life, and you plant that into everybody else's life. See, that's the outcome of godly wisdom. Godly wisdom may not make me rich or famous or successful in a business sense or, you know, prosperous in the worldly way. It may not win friends and influence people, no matter whose book I read. But godly wisdom will begin that cycle of peace in my life, which leads to more righteousness, not a quantity of rightness with God, but walking in the reality of being who I ought to be. And then I'm more peaceful. And then I'm even more who God made me to be. And then it starts affecting you. You know, I've seen people led to Christ without a word being uttered or a single tract being pulled out of the pocket. Just the effect, the witness of the person's life. Faith. Faith that works embraces true wisdom. So that leads us to the last question. Which wisdom are you embracing? The wisdom of the world or the wisdom of the Lord? Are your daily decisions based on the wisdom of the world? You know, Romans 12:2 warns us. It says, don't be conformed to the world. Let's just extrapolate. Don't make decisions based on the wisdom of the world. You know, are you doing that? Or are the decisions you make based on the wisdom from above, because you have a relationship with the one who's from above? When you surrender your life to follow Jesus, he promises to give you the wisdom and the courage to make right decisions and the ability and the power to follow up on them. Now, that seems like a good idea at this time. And it is.